Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, it's Peter Oborne in West London.
Hello, it's Richard Heller in South East London.
And we've got one of my lifelong heroes, and Richard's lifelong heroes with us today, Pat Murphy. Cricket commentator, football commentator, broadcaster, author, and above all, more important than anything else, I think, a proper journalist, a proper reporter, tells you what's happening. Pat Murphy, so nice to have you here. When was the first cricket report you made? Because I've been listening to you all my life, and I'm quite old.
That actually makes me feel antique. I think I should be examined by Fiona Bruce on the Sunday night on BBC television. As it were. When people say, oh, proper journalist, I find myself thinking, that's a euphemism for somebody who's got many a ring around his bark. In my case, it's 50 years last June that I got into journalism on the Peter Reading Telegraph, and then bluffed my way into the BBC in 1974. Working on news as well as sport, I thought it was important to get a grounding in news. I had a law degree, and I thought it was really important actually to get the fulcrum of a profession in structure. And I'm glad to say in all my time, despite sailing very close to the wind, I've never yet copped a libel action, which I'm very proud about, because when you do make a point of actually trying very hard to tell it like it is, sometimes my learned friends start tugging at your elbow. In terms of cricket, the first cricket commentary I did would be in the summer of 1975, on my days off from working for television, Midlands Today, up here in the Midlands, when I had hair and prospects, I worked for Radio Birmingham Sport with Jim Rosenthal and Nick Cohen, who taught me a hell of a lot. And during those periods, I'd be working with them at Warwickshire, Edgbaston, and at New Road, the glorious New Road. I think they called it the Black Finch Road now, did they, or something horrible like that?
They haven't. Where the cathedral, they've changed its name. They do have a D'Oliveira stand, though, don't they?
They do, and so they should. And a Graham Hick Pavilion. It'll always be New Road, Worcester to me. So my love affair with cricket began many moons earlier than that, but in terms of the practicalities, it would be 1975 with Radio Birmingham.
Pat, I'm sure you'd agree, historically, the way in which cricket's reported has been very important to its development in lots of countries, particularly in the radio era. And you must have seen sort of huge changes in your time in the whole way in which cricket is reported in all media.
Yes.
Yes. I wonder if you'd like to reflect on these.
I remember growing up listening to Test Match Special, which started in 1957. I always loved the close of play summaries. I know E.W. Swanton was seen by many people as a rather pompous old bore, but in many cases, actually, he was quite ahead of his time, quite advanced. He was, to my mind, very sound and proactive about West Indies cricket and about apartheid South Africa and the D'Oliveira affair. I think from his Daily Telegraph pulpit, he offered many sound and compassionate observations about the D'Oliveira affair. Which will surprise many people who thought he was an arch-establishment figure. But I loved his close-of-play summaries. He'd begin rather pompously with, I shall start with the score. And then he'd go through the whole scorecard, etc.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's really rather an important thing for anybody to bear in mind. Start with the score. And that's what I've tried to do in both football and cricket, whether it's a 10-second piece, minute and a half, or whatever. And in terms of cricket, when the scoreboard changes, i.e. a run accrues in any which way, you must, in my opinion, must give the score subsequently because it's changed. And if it's changed via the electronic media, you must tell the listeners it has changed. They're not sat alongside you. They're wishing they could be there alongside you in many cases. But you must let them know you've got the best seat in the house and that you are there as the conduit.
I so agree with you. And I don't often get the sense that they're doing that on Test Match Special these days. I remember a penultimate day of that wonderful first test against Pakistan. The commentator, I'll spare his blood, I won't name him. He went off on a five-minute riff about how he played table tennis and drunk Chardonnay at the hotel the night before. This was just at the moment when the tension was at its most a gripping, and instead we had a very self-indulgent piece of posturing from a TMS commentator, and it really, I felt, was disgraceful.
Well, Peter, I didn't hear that, and it would be remiss of me actually to single out particular episodes as well from people who were, until recently, colleagues of mine. What I will say, the other side of the coin, last year, the Leeds Test match, Ben Stokes, his wonderful virtuoso performance. I thought the last hour and a bit involving Jim Maxwell, Jonathan Agnew as commentators, and Michael Vaughan and Glenn McGrath really caught the emotion and the tension of that particular game. And I'm very happy to sit at home in the garden listening to that, totally wrapped. And I thought they got it absolutely bang on. Just because I was wittering on there about the need to always flag up the fact the score has changed doesn't necessarily mean that I'm now criticising the modern breed of commentary. It's different, but so is life. My commentary hero will always remain John Arlott. I do believe in the 70s, TMS had a very, very strong cadre of commentators reflecting the light and shade. You had John Arlott and Don Mosey, Keighley Grammar School and the University of Life, who used words very, very well indeed. You had Brian Johnson providing the light, no question about that. You had Tony Lewis nipped in now and again, visiting commentators, people like Tony Cozier, who was, to my mind, superb, Alan McGilvray. I thought during that period, Test Match Special reached its apogee, reflecting all the nuances you need in society, never mind those who actually broadcast and those who follow the game.
You didn't mention the summarisers there, you know, Trevor Bailey and Fred Truman, who also first class, and they didn't barge in all the time the way they're encouraged to do now. They allowed the commentator to create a picture as he was commentating.
I think that's a reflection, Peter, on our society, whereby things are much more instant than they were, and less reflective than they were. It may be indicative of the fact that we're all getting older, and that's what we preferred. I'm not saying what's right and what's wrong. I'm just giving you my own personal opinion. I agree with you about Trevor Bailey and Fred Truman. What I do feel is that I believe it's right to have a roster of summarizers. Fred and Trevor did it all summer. And after a time, no matter how well disposed you are to the summarizers, after a time, it becomes just a little bit repetitive. And I think it's a good idea you have different summarizers now across the board in a busy radio commentary summer. I'm all for Mark Ramprakash and these sort of people nipping in and out, giving you insights from the dressing room. With the best will in the world, Trevor and Fred could not bring you modern, up-to-date insights from the current England dressing room.
Now, one thing I've always felt, I've been cross about it, to be honest, that we haven't had you in that commentator's chair. And it's been obvious to me for a long time that you should have been one of them.
That's not for me to say, Peter. And if you felt that way, I wish you'd actually written a letter every week on that particular basis. I was tried out, 83 World Cup. I did commentary in some of the games for what could be called loosely TMS, alongside all the great and the good. I don't think I probably did it all that well. I suspect the bosses came to that same conclusion. As ever in the media, you don't often find out how you've done if you have done not very well. People tend not to want to pass bad news on to you. So I came to the conclusion that it probably wasn't for me in the eyes of people who make these appointments. But then pretty soon Radio 5 and then Radio 5 Live came along, which was, as you know, a 24/7 coverage of everything, news and sport, et cetera, from 1990 onwards. I'd already done a few overseas tours in any event and also presented Test Match Special in some summers and certainly some winters from the bowels of Broadcasting House. So I was across the programme and part of it and doing post-match interviews, et cetera. So I'm not going to beat my breast about all this. But Radio 5 and then Radio 5 Live from 1990 onwards, in the eyes of the bosses, that seemed to be my métier. That's what they felt. And therefore, perhaps because I'd had the disciplines from my upbringing as a provincial journalist in local radio, I could talk to time. I believe the merit of talking to time is always very, very important.
I'm going to say some things which you wouldn't say. I think it's counted against you that you're cussed and you always speak the truth. I think it's Mayor counted against you, that you're a provincial journalist. It's a great tradition in this country. We're a country, we're not just based in London, and you're not a celebrity journalist. You know, there's a, and you're the real thing. And I think that there's something about the culture, maybe in some places, where the real thing doesn't fit. But that's another...
Go, I make no apologies for being educated at a high school in Scotland and then going to the University of Hull to read law. And that's absolutely fine. You're a product of your own background, and that has never bothered me at all about where I sprang from. And hey-ho, you play the cards you dealt with. I have absolutely no complaints about any of that, and that's very kind of you to say that, but... That's up to other people, Peter, to say these things, not to me. I just think the essence, if I may say so, of broadcasting is that you actually try to be yourself. One of my real heroes across the board was Terry Wogan. And I never met him, but so many people told me Terry Wogan was exactly the same sort of person you meet in private as he was on air. To me, he was a joy. Literate, eloquent, wonderful sense of humour, superb voice. Very happy to make literary references, never talk down to his audience. So people like them, I think what you've got to try to do in your broadcasting career is be as you are off mic. So that's what I've always aspired to be, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, I just want to step back a little bit, Pat, and think about the way cricket's covered in general. It seems to me, see how you feel about it, it seems to me that the major changes are we've got the influence of social media, which means that basically anybody in the world now can be a cricket writer and analyst without sort of any training at all. You've got a huge amount of, as it were, cricket output being pumped out by all sorts of people. Through social media, players themselves are pumping out far more material than in the old days. It seems to me, from my memory, you hardly heard from players at all, except a, you know, rather short pro forma interviews where they never said anything very much. And a third thing that seems to be very new and significant is that many more women are involved in cricket reporting and analysis, and they're adding something new to cricket coverage, and a good thing too.
Well, dealing with the latter, first of all, Richard, that's how it should be. There's no question at all that's an improvement, that is progress, game, set and match. There's no point in discussing any further. So it should be good. Second point about players, it suits the players now also, you know, to go on social media. I'm on social media because I like to know what people are saying. And I like to give it out and take it as well. If somebody gives me a serve, I'll give them a serve back within the constraints. But at the same time, it's nice to hear what your listeners are saying. But in many cases, the players actually want to be on social media. They can plug their wares, as it were. Mm. The business managers, their agents, etc., they make it quite clear it's a good idea to be on Twitter because they'll plug cricket clothing and gigs that they're doing and books and articles and all that malarkey. They're not backward and coming forward in terms of saying, well, this is what I'm doing now. I don't blame them for that either, because in many cases in the past, they've been there to be shot at. I think it's only fair they have a right of reply within reason. In terms of the accountability, fans with laptops, that is actually one of the things that does worry me, whereby everybody seems to have an opinion. But how can you deny people having that opinion? You may well think, well, this is a load of rubbish. When I first went on Twitter, I was told by one of my bosses, just imagine that you are on air talking for the BBC. So be careful. And so after a few Beecher's Brooks and Valentine's early on, before I got round the course just once, I was made quite clear that I couldn't talk about particular bete noirs of mine that have often given me a fit of the vapors. So I had to hold my tongue to a certain extent. And also, I think it's important that you should think, never ever tweet when you've had a glass or two, when you've supped rather well and not too wisely. So I've tried very hard to steer clear of that. But you can't avoid getting sucked into the maw of controversy, whereby people do actually try to lead you on, and that can be rather difficult. One more thing to say about modern coverage. I deplore the absence of coverage of county cricket. I deplore the fact that papers like The Telegraph, which in my youth were a paper of record in terms of the county game, E.W. Swanson's Monday commentaries were superb. And now I get the feeling that more and more people are being cut adrift who cover the county game so that the appropriate sports editors, their budgets can accommodate big name celebrities offering their views that they can't write about themselves, that they need to have a ghost to write about it for them, i.e. that despised group journalists. How useful can we journalists be sometimes to players and managers after they berate us unceasingly? Suddenly we become useful when they want us to write a book or an article for them.
Everything you say is complete music to my ears. I agree with everything, in particular the fall off of first-class cricket, county cricket coverage. Listening to you there, Pat, you've talked about your bête noires, controversial statement, sailing close to the wind. I know that this will be published, this podcast. Can you give us any clues about what your bête noires might be?
Well, I've always felt that Rupert Murdoch has done more to coarsen public life in this country than any other individual, aided by his lieutenants such as Kelvin McKenzie. And I recall very early on throwing a few volleys in their direction when they came on Twitter. And I was told in no uncertain terms by my bosses that I need to steer clear of those sort of things, which I obviously had to do because they employ me. But I've always felt that the BBC has been unnecessarily timorous towards Mr. Murdoch and his cohorts. So anybody who knows me knows that I fulminate about the influence of Sky via Murdoch's influence on the landscape of broadcasting. I do believe that there's been a marketing triumph. I fully acknowledge that their coverage is outstanding, but that's because they've got to fill lots and lots of channels and lots of holes. And people tend to forget they borrowed a lot from Channel 9, the technical expertise from Australia that I witnessed at first hand in the 80s and the early 90s. So yeah, Murdoch in particular has always been one of the things that's caused one or two Vesuvius eruptions from me down the years. I watched the BBC programme on Murdoch the other day, the series three-parter. I have to say, I don't think there was anything in that. I enjoyed it enormously. A lot of friends of mine said, oh, you were right, it's worth watching. I kept saying to him, I've been going on about this for decades. What are you talking about? I don't think I actually learned anything from that series because I've closely followed his career and his malignant hold on our society in this country. I don't really see why somebody who owns so many newspapers nationally should also have such a massive influence via electronic media. It's common knowledge that he's influenced every prime minister since James Callaghan, from Margaret Thatcher onwards, all the way through. The prime ministers have tugged their forelock in the direction of Rupert Murdoch. And I also believe that, well, I have to choose my words extremely carefully. There have been various campaigns and decisions by the electorate, both in this country and across the water in the USA, that have been influenced by Rupert Murdoch, in my opinion.
Yes, there's no question about that. Fox News played the paramount role in getting Trump elected in 2016. It's probably going to do this, is going to do its damnedest to do the same this time. To move on to your...
For a moment and go back to commentary for a little bit? Because I'd just like to make a point we've made in other podcasts and talked about with other guests. We've had it suggested that cricket is the absolute ideal game to commentate on because of its structure. Bowler bowls, batter receives, fielders react. It gives you time to, as you say, give the score, say what's happened, and give a little bit of analysis without having to gabble out what's happening. And I wonder if you felt that was... how you felt about that, Pat, and how it compares to football. Are you constantly in football, just trying to keep up with the action?
I do agree with you. I think an effects microphone is a very, very important piece of our kit in broadcasting cricket because you can then hear the hum of the crowd and that matchless sound of bat on ball and the polite applause or raucous applause, etc. You can do so much with good effects and that adds to the texture of the commentary. I was so lucky when I got this job. I knew John Arler anyway, having written Basil D'Oliveira's autobiography for him and done some work by the Professional Cricket Association. John was the president then. So I knew John anyway when I got this particular job in 1981 for BBC National Radio Sport. John sent me a letter, I still have it, saying, come on over. I know you galley slaves in outside broadcast don't get a lot of time. Come on over. So John sat me down for a day and a half talking to me about broadcasting. How lucky was I? And he said, never forget the blind person. look to your left and to your right, not just down the line of stumps, and bring in everything you can think of. I can't believe how lucky it was that somebody like John Arlott was giving me the time.
A bit like being taught painting by Picasso, by one of the greatest master of the art. What were his other advice? It's just completely wonderful to hear this.
And also, at the time, I was writing the book on the 20 batsmen who scored 100 first-class centuries. At the time, it was W.G. Grace's Zahir. John knew 18 of those 20, beginning with Philip Mead, number three. So it's fantastic to get John's insight into 18 of the 20 history makers. Anyway, back to the point of effects. And if you listen to John Arlott, for example, and Brian Johnson, who was a wonderful, massively experienced outside broadcaster with a lovely light tone, they knew when to bring in instinctively the sound of people actually at the event. And that to me is really important. Now, other sports, horse racing, I'm consumed in admiration for the likes of Peter O'Sullivan, and Peter Bromley in particular, because in my early days outside broadcast, I produced Peter Bromley when he was doing racing at, say, Cheltenham or Nottingham. And I look at his racing car, the amount of research, the colours, everything else on his racing car, absolutely fantastic. And how he, and now John Hunt on Radio 5 Live, how they build it up to a crescendo when you think there's nowhere else to go in their voices and their intonation and the way they're rising to that crescendo, and they always find another level. I think it's an absolute art being a racing commentator. I wouldn't know where to begin in that particular area. And football commentary as well. Peter Jones, I worked with him many times, produced him, died tragically while commentating on the 1990 boat race. Peter was a master at bringing in the crowd as well. He just knew when to keep quiet. He had a dramatist's eye and ear for the whoop and the wharf of an outside broadcast. And people like them are gems.
It reminds me what you're saying of, I think John Arlott was commentating when Bradman was out at the Oval in his final innings. And I think I was told by somebody, you'll know better, I think, that he didn't say a word. He just allowed a Bradman walking back to the pavilion. The listener could hear, just only heard the crowd.
Brilliant. And let's not forget, Peter, John had only been commentating on cricket for 2 years. He did the 1946 Indian tour over here, having had lots of other jobs outside broadcasting for the World Service, the Eastern section of the World Service. And the boss of outside broadcast at the time was a typical BBC Mandarin in those days. And he said at the end, he said, Arlott, you have a vulgar voice, but an interesting mind. We're going to give you another chance. And so John was only 30, in his late 36 or something like that, when he was doing things like that Brabham commentary in 1948. So he quickly learned. But my favourite clip from John Arlott was Neil Hawke, as you know, was not exactly an aesthetic delight scuttling into bowl for Australia in the 1960s. And John said on one occasion, here comes Hawke, running into bowl, like Groucho Marx chasing a waitress.
Now, we think, he used that phrase also against Masood, the Pakistani bowler.
Yes, 1971, Edgbaston. You're right. If the line is worth using once, it's worth using twice.
And he had that wonderful opportunity of saying when two players of man were opposing each other, one of them got the other out, didn't he?
Man.
Didn't he?
Yeah. Yep. John Rice of Hampshire bowling, Andy Murtagh of Hampshire Fielding, who was Irish born. There we are, Rice Bowls and Paddy Fields.
You did that one.
I hadn't heard that one before.
I didn't. I hadn't heard that. Yeah. I mean, John Radley, the rather dour and boring Middlesex batsman who played for England, the artisan, he called him. I remember that.
Yes. Yeah, but with respect, because John was a huge fan of county cricketers, and he said being president of the PCA was one of the great honours of his life. So John would never be dismissive of any county cricketer, no matter how modest their talents.
And he also had an enormous personal humility. You knew Basil D'Oliveira better than I did, but D'Oliveira told me when he was coach at Worcestershire, Arlott would turn up and ask permission to talk to the players. And
yes.
Then, there was a manners about it.
Yes, and every throughout a period of time, everyone who played his first test match for England at home, on the first night of that test match, they'd be taken out to dinner by John Arlott. You're talking Botham, Gower, and all these people. And to the best of my knowledge, nobody ever refused John Arlott on day one of their test match debut.
I never knew that.
I didn't know that. But you mentioned crowd effects a moment ago, and of course now there's, for the moment, there are no crowd effects to cut away to, and there are no cutaway shots for for the television to see. How much harder is that going to be for commentators? And in fact, how much is that going to reduce the appeal of sporting events generally to the public?
I'm not part of it anymore in terms of cricket. I do feel for the commentators, certainly, because there are less things to pick up on. And I actually feel for the camera people as well, because the camera people, they do like a few visual distractions, don't they? I'll put it no higher than that, particularly, if I may say, during Football World Cups when Brazil are playing. But for me, I did football the last couple of months. I did 7 games upon resumption. And it was really hard, about 200 people in the ground. And I remember covering West Brom against QPR when West Brom got a draw at the death and therefore they got promoted. And it was a great game, a really dramatic game. It was very, very hard to get up for that one. I got distracted, so much so that I came out with a phrase that got into private eye, about which I'm very proud. You used to call it Coleman balls. It's basically commentator balls now. I've been trying for years.
It took you 44 years, I think, didn't it?
I actually said, here we are, the referee, they came to me for commentary for the last couple of minutes. The referee's looking at his watch and he's about to blow his whistle. No, I'll get this right. The referee's looking at his whistle and he's about to blow his watch. That's right. That's what I said. Mercifully, private eye, I'm proud they actually included me. So it was a highlight of my career.
It's framed. It's in the lavatory, is it?
Yes, exactly. The funny thing is, at the end of that game, I managed to escape out the side door. There were thousands of West Brom fans outside the gates waiting to cheer their heroes. God knows, A, what time they would be turning up to see them, B, how much time the players would spend in their dark and blackened out windows signing autographs, and C, how little social distancing was going on that night in the Black Country.
A great moment, though. It sounds like you've got a wealth of anecdotes you could tell us, Pat. What are your top three after dinner ideas?
Well, I do recall once, I'll start with telling the story against myself, because when you're doing things live, you're always hostage to fortune. There's always a chance you're on that precipice whereby you nearly tumble over. My word, I've done it often enough myself. It was a football game and I was extolling the virtues of a fairly utilitarian player who was getting a fair amount of stick, both in the media and also the home fans. And I did say, well, hang on, he's not that bad, you know. He said 7 craps for England.
Did you get picked up for that?
Of course I did. Of course, yeah. It'd be wrong to say it went viral, but everybody knew about it. I remember a great sledge towards Matthew Hayden. Now, Matthew Hayden, desperate Dan of an opening batsman, as you know, barrel-chested, massive figure, imposed himself on so many people. But towards the end of his career, he was losing it. It comes to everybody. It wasn't as good as he was. And he started to bring out lots of cookery books, getting in touch with his more thoughtful side. And he'd be on the breakfast sofas over there in Australia talking about his new book, his recipes and all the rest of it. And everybody thought that was really funny. But anyway, he was out cheaply again at the SCG. And as he trailed off disconsolately, this guy leant over and said, Hayden, you're crap. And so's your recipe for ratatouille. I remember Henry Blofeld, who was a very, very sharp mind, Henry. He played that Worcesterish role to perfection, but he was very cute and savvy. And he arrived for an England tour once in Australia. And he's at passport control. And a brusque Aussie official saying, you're rubbish, you lot. There's no point in you turning up. We're going to beat you 5-0. Mr. Blofeld, any criminal convictions? As he looked at his form, his list, and Blower said, quick as a flash, cravat at a rakish angle, spats looking immaculate and looking for all the world like an eccentric English gentleman, said, hey, my dear old thing, I didn't know they were compulsory in this country.
Yes, I can well imagine Henry doing that.
Collapse of stout party.
Yep.
I'd love to have been with Henry Blofeld and John Woodcock when they drove overland.
Yeah.
It was like 77 tour of India, Pakistan, and they drove out from London to... You could still do it in those days, too. Yeah.
I'm with you entirely. I only got a flavour of such a leisurely ambience on the 86-87 tour, Gatting's tour, when England won everything bar the Melbourne Cup. Great, very happy tour to be on. And Jack Bannister and I drove just for Christmas on the Pacific Highway from Adelaide to Melbourne for the Christmas Test match. And in those days, there was no 24/7 imperatives. And Christopher Martin Jenkins was there anyway as correspondent of the BBC. I was helping out. And that was wonderful. It was wonderful in terms of being able to spend 5 days or so different locations, talking to very, very friendly Aussies. And they do exist in terms of the Poms. Savouring the wines, etc., getting to Melbourne just in time for Christmas, and that was memorable. So I do envy those media and players who used to travel for 6 weeks or so to places like Australia.
Yes, John Woodcock, I remember him saying that he went out as a very junior reporter for the Times on his first Ashes tour, the full 6 weeks, and Neville Cardus took a shine to him, and he got a bit... But after 6 weeks of having dinner on his own with Neville Cardus, it was getting a bit much. Great man though Neville Cardus was.
He talked about Gustav Mahler rather than Robin Mahler.
Yes, I think most cricketers wouldn't have heard of Gustav Mahler, would they?
I think we should get on to Pat's books, because there are 43 yes. of them, at least, aren't there?
You're very welcome.
Yeah.
That's the rest of the day sorted.
How much time have you got? But just first of all, in general, I think I'm right in saying 43 books, authored or ghosted, subjects included, including Botham, Brian Clough, Flintoff, Viv Richards, Imran Khan, Graham Gooch, Alex Stewart. I remember sporting autobiographies in the 50s and 60s when I was a kid, and they were generally very, very bland.
Yeah, you're right. They were anodyne, but, you know, a lot of public life was anodyne in those days, wasn't it? It was conformist, and people didn't necessarily step out of line too much vocally, did they? So, again, sport was reflecting the society.
But public now expect quite a lot more in a sporting autobiography, don't they?
And I think the public are right to do so as well.
Yeah.
The public should be treated with respect in these terms, because we all know that there are disputes, there are temperamental differences, there are situations where players just don't get on. And I don't really see why it should be so anodyne. I think we should reflect how life is as much as we possibly can. I love doing books of Bob Willis, because Bob would never sit on the fence. He'd always say exactly what he felt. And to me, he was a joy to work with, because he was always ready for something to say and didn't flinch with his observations. I remember ghosting stuff for David Gower in the 1989 summer. And David was obviously battening down the hatches as England lurched from crisis to crisis against the Australians. David quite liked mentioning a certain champagne. On this occasion, Mike Turner, the chief executive of Leicester, said, "Pat, you've got to stop David mentioning this particular champagne, you know." So I said, "I'll do my best." He said, "Well, England are getting hammered. There's no time to be talking about champagne." That was the attractiveness of David, to be frank. I said, "Well, David, we've got to stop mentioning this particular champagne." He said, "You don't understand, though, mate. Every time I mention this, I get a free crate." "Push some my way, then, David." But the role of a ghost has to be to get the person talking in the authentic voice, how that person speaks and the terminology that they use, and also just to nudge them and remind them of things so you can let people know how they did it. There was a book I wrote with love him to bits, Mike Proctor. Great lad, known him a long, long time, towards the end of his career. "Right, Procky, we're at that game now, late 1779 against Yorkshire. You got 100, you got 2 LBW hat tricks. Tell us all about it." "Oh, I can't remember, mate. I can tell you where we had a few beers that night." "Yeah, okay, right. No. You'll fill it." "I can't fill it. You were there, not me." "It's in Wisden, isn't it?" "Yeah, a couple of lines." It was a nightmare. And listening back to that track, all I could hear was the sound of a match striking on the matchbox as he had yet another fag, and the hiss of a swan lark had been opened as we carried on working. but I love Mike Proctor a bit, but some were more challenging and more fulfilling to work with than dear old Mike, who to this day I still think very fondly of him.
How long did it take you to write a Ghosted book?
Oh, it depended so much on the time scales. Let's say it could be about 20 sessions lasting an afternoon or a morning. Bob Willis and I always used to have this private joke. Right, it's 12:29, time to the pub. We'd go to the Prince of Wales pub in Cambridge Street, Birmingham, and drink splendid real ale. We lived near each other. Splendid real ale for quite some time thereafter. Never did any work thereafter. Bob was an insomniac, so he was all ready to start working at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'd stagger there about 10 o'clock, having lived a typical bachelor lifestyle, thinking, my God, what am I going to ask Bob? But he was always ready. So, and then you go away into Perda, put the towel over your head, and work hard at it. My Warwickshire book that I came out with last year, that was a product of my memories from the Warwickshire boys, many of whom were personal friends, and then tracking them all down, Andy Moles in Cape Town, Trevor Penny in Quebec, that sort of stuff, and then sitting there thinking, how am I going to make this different rather than match after match after match? I had to look at themes, etc. But I actually wrote it. It was over 100,000 words. I actually wrote it in about 3 weeks. It was quite easy.
Gracious.
When I'd worked out the structure. The discipline's important, and the synopsis is crucial. You just keep thinking, how am I going to get started on this one? When you ghost a book, you've got to go straight in with an incident that gets people by the necessary, rather than, well, I was born in 1928 and my parents were lovely. Don't want any of that.
So your Warwickshire book, you're going at 5,000 words a day. That's motoring, even by the standards of Agatha Christie or Barbara Cartland. You're motoring, aren't you? Yeah.
Pink's my favourite colour. Nobody's ever mentioned me in the context of those two, but I repeat, that one was in me, as it
yeah,
were, somewhat
yeah.
harder than others. I just felt
it's a labour of love, but it's real labour of love. But you're a
yes,
Warwickshire,
it was a labour of love. You nearly said I'm a Warwickshire man there, but be very careful, because throughout my long career, Radio Sport, whenever Nottinghamshire were winning county championships, I was there at Trent Bridge all the time. Whenever Worcestershire were winning titles, both in Dilly & Co, I was there all the time. And it was exactly the same with Warwickshire. So I'd hate people to think that my proclivities were all towards a bare and ragged staff. My proclivities were to county cricket, which I love with an enduring passion. So it was always an absolute joy to go to cover county cricket on the morning, yarning with the umpires, quick word with the coach, any injuries, that sort of stuff, leisurely cup of coffee, catch up on the gossip. Absolutely lovely to cover county cricket in many, many ways. So the Warwickshire one, to me, was one of the easier books I've done, one of the more satisfying ones. And, you know, I didn't find 5,000 words a day much of a trial. The thing to do is get your mind right, get your prep done the night before, get up in the morning, shower, shave. Don't sit at your desk unshaven. Good breakfast. Be smart, bright and breezy. Get the brain cells going early. Have your intro in your mind while you're showering. Mm. What am I going to write? It's all about discipline and doing the prep the night before, having read your chapter in late afternoon that you've just done and that you were satisfied with it. Just a structure, really. No mystique.
I think your Warwickshire book is superb, Pat, because for many reasons. One of them bringing the fact that you brought in so many people, including the backroom staff, and we don't often hear from. They all got their place in the sun. But particularly because it's not just a celebration. You know, you look at some underlying problems in that team, and you write about them frankly as they happened.
Thank you for that, Richard. I'm glad you've brought that out. It was very important to me that people like Keith Cook and Dennis Ames, chief executive, and Stuart Nottingham, the physio, that they were featured, because in many cases they got the players out there on the pitch. And the deal whereby Lara was signed for £40,000 before he got his 375 was absolutely astonishing, because Keith Cook told me that they trebled that amount through new membership, which was fantastic. Also, the thing about successful sports, the chemistry, the attitude and the dressing towards each other, it was really interesting, because I've written Dermot Rees' book for him, by the way, Winning Ways, and he was terrific to do a book with, fizzing with ideas and strong observations. But Dermot was not the most popular captain Warwickshire ever had. He was the best, in my opinion, and that's with gracious acknowledgement to MJK Smith. He was their best captain, but he wasn't popular, and a lot of the players, they play for Dermot Reeve, the captain, but they wouldn't play for Dermot Reeve, the person, whereas they would for Tim Munton. And the antipathy between Brian Lara and Dermot Reeve was well known also. But crossing that white line and doing it for the team is always something that fascinated me in sport, not just cricket. And Warwickshire were the epitome of that, whereby they just managed to put things to one side. And it's very interesting how the team broke up so soon, thus subsequently, in 96. And don't forget, Warwickshire won 6 trophies in 24 months from September 93 to December 95, which is a remarkable achievement in the history of county cricket, which goes back to 1877. No team has been so successful over so many competitions in such a short period of time. And that's why they were history makers. They weren't the best county side ever, but they were statistically the best in a short period of time. But Dermot Reeve had to retire midway through the 96 season. Various players had personal problems. Keith Piper, Paul Smith, people like Dickie Davis went off to other counties. Munton had injury problems. Gladstone Small coming to the end of his time. Brian Lara didn't cut it when he came back in 98. Everything fell apart forevermore. And the transient nature of sporting success always fascinated me. And that was certainly the case with Warwickshire from 94 to 96.
I mean, you're so experienced, Pat, at ghosting. I mean, quite often you may find yourself wanting to write a portrait of a player which isn't one he would like at all. How do you deal with that?
Very good question. Well, I recall 78-9 tour. I ghosted the tour diary with the oldest player, a man I have great reverence for, Bob Taylor, and the youngest, David Gower. It was called Anyone for Cricket. And it was lucky that England won 5-1. David enjoyed himself, and they were sending airmails back to me, believe it or not. And David would mention now and again that had a good night out, et cetera, et cetera. So I was keen to get a fair amount of that in. But David, pretty savvy, even at the age of 21/22, knew that even though he was telling me that, we had to keep quiet about that as much as we possibly could. So there was that sort of pull the punches to a certain extent on that one. Graham Dilley, I wrote the diary of the season with Graham Dilley and Graham Hick when Worcestershire won the title in 1989, coinciding with Graham Dilley signing for this African tour, Mike Gatting's tour. Appalling title. We were sitting there working at what we're going to call this. Graham Dilley was filling ashtrays, and Graham Hick and I were having a nice glass of Chardonnay, and we couldn't think what we were going to call it. And Graham Dilley said, "Oh, it's such a circus, isn't it? This kind of cricket." I said, "I've got it, Hick and Dilley Circus." I don't think that was a particularly clever title, far from it. But the boys were quite happy to go with it. And I must admit, I forced it on them, which was my fault. And then when Chris Broad, I wrote a book with Chris Broad, and he was very, very strong about Tim Robinson, his batting partner, wanted to keep a few things out that he told me all about. And so we had a bit of a tussle about that. But fair enough, the book's in their name and they've got to do the media. But again, that was an appalling title. Instead of the Chris Broad story, I lent a bit on Robert Browning, and it'd be wrong to say Chris was a world expert on the poet Browning. And I said, "Well, let's call it Home Truths from Abroad." I agree. That was another one to groan about. But getting back to the Hick and Dilley Circus book, Graham Dilley was going through a divorce at the time as well. And his knee was giving him jip, and he was going to South Africa. And it was really quite dramatic in his personal life. And I wanted to get more of that in. Graham was thinking about, obviously, his children, the personal aspect of it. If it's a diary of a season, it should be a diary of somebody's life during that season as well. But I didn't push it as much as I should do, because, again, I knew that Graham was coming to a finite end of his career, really. It was one more payday, that South Africa trip for Graham Dilley. And I'm glad to say that Graham Dilley prevailed, and a lot of the stuff he'd already told me didn't make it. And on reflection, I'm glad that was the case, because we remained very good friends until he died, sadly, prematurely, of cancer. So I'm glad I was not as strong as I should have been at that particular stage.
Tiger Smith, a fascinating book to me, Pat, because, you know, you've got such an astonishing span of cricket history in one life. You've got somebody who played...
E.J. Tiger Smith. He was known as Tiger because he was a very famous boxer at that time, Tiger Smith as well. That's why Ernest James Smith was known as Tiger. He first saw Warwickshire play up a tree in 1894 outside the ground. He came from an impoverished part of South Birmingham. And his love affair with Warwickshire lasted from 1894 to 1979. At the time, he was the oldest Test match cricketer, age 73. I can see him now. In May 1979, India Test match at Edgbaston, in the dining room, telling Mike Brearley where he was going wrong with his batting, tapping his stick. Yeah, hold that stick, Mike Brearley, England captain. He said, you're waving it around all over the place. It was absolutely fantastic. And the respect that Mike Brearley showed for Tiger was graphic also, because Tiger was a coach as well. He coached Warwickshire to the 1951 championship title. He was a Test match umpire in the 1930s. Significantly, just after he retired in 1930, Warwickshire put his name forward, and in December 1930, he was told he was umpiring the following summer. No exams, nothing written. They figured that as he'd played cricket for 20-odd years, he knew enough about the game. Within 2 years, he's umpiring in Test matches. Tiger knew cricket inside out and taught me so much. I visited him on his deathbed the day before. He passed away in August 79, and he was a funny old boy. He said he liked to drink, Tiger, liked to beer. He said, Pat, I want hops on my coffin, not lilies, so people can remember I liked to beer. And he wouldn't let me publish the book until he died, so he didn't come out until a year later. But my word, this was the late 70s. I'd sit there with him. He'd be drinking a rum, and I'd be having a beer with him in his house. And Rose, his wife, was so helpful. And this is he just oozed practical knowledge. This is the man who was captained by W.G. Grace for London County.
Crikey.
He said to him one day, I didn't know you could bat. He said, well, you never asked me. In those days, pros did not talk to amateurs like that. This is the man who stood behind Victor Trumper in his last Test match. And Trumper, who was already coughing badly, 1912, and as you know, he died of Bright's disease a couple of years later. He said, they're trying to get rid of me, Vic. They don't rate me anymore. Tiger said, Vic, all I can say to you is it's been a pleasure keeping wicket to you, Victor Trumper. This is a man who's big, big friends with S.F. Barnes.
The greatest bowler of all time.
To my mind, the greatest English bowler of all time. Quite right. You mentioned S.F. Barnes now to modern England cricketers, and they say, I need to see the footage. Sorry, can't help. His last Test match was 1914. Just look at his record. Anyway, Melbourne, 1911. Barnes took four wickets. At lunchtime, he had four for three off nine overs. He hadn't been feeling very well. Barnes bowled like a god. He got Hill, he got Kellaway, he got Armstrong, he got Warren Barnsley in quick succession. And he said to the dressing room attendant, I want some wine. Can you bring me a bottle of wine at lunchtime? And the manager said, Major Pawley, we're not paying for that. He said, I don't care. I'm paying for it. I've done my job this morning. And Tiger said, I'll have some of that, the wicketkeeper. So they climbed in, drank a bottle of wine at lunchtime before going out to bowl Australia out for spit. And this is the man who took 49 wickets in his first four Test matches in South Africa on matting, 1913-14. He wouldn't play the last Test match. His wife and child were over. He thought, oh, stuff this. We won the series. I'm going home early. Pros didn't do those sort of things when amateurs were captaining in those days. And Tiger was right at S.F. Barnes' elbow during all that time. He was a splendid nonconformist, Tiger Smith. I loved him to bits, and he taught me so much about the game.
It comes through in his book, the book you wrote, Pat.
Thank you.
It comes through that he's a very independent-minded man. He didn't knuckle under to anybody, particularly the... You know, the amateurs.
Here's one for you about Tiger. I did not know this. I got his grandson playing for the cricket team that I ran, the BBC cricket team, qualification. You want to watch the 10 o'clock news. And Tiger, I made sure the small advance that I got from the publishers, I made sure the family got it because I was so honoured to do it. Tiger knew about this, didn't make a fuss, blah, blah, blah. His grandson rang me up after on the day that Tiger died. He said, Tiger's left you all his wisdoms. So these were from 1903, 1906, all that Tiger's period as player and umpire. So he left me about 30 wisdoms. I was absolutely honoured that he'd done that. That was his way from beyond the grave of thanking me, I hope, for his friendship and my admiration. But I had no idea he was going to do that. But I was absolutely privileged to make sure that the family, who weren't all that wealthy, I made sure the family got the advance from the book.
A book of yours I really loved, Pat, was because it was you just brought up people's lives, and the long, diligent interviews you did with them was The Spinner's Turn, which you, history of English spin, based on personal interviews with the leading practitioners in the post-war era. And one of the messages was it basically that spinning was a dead art. You wrote that book, I think, in 1980, and of course you couldn't have been more wrong. It was just about to resurrect itself.
It was a lament for the decline of spin bowling at that time. I yield to nobody my admiration for the West Indies juggernaut of that period, but I was getting fed up of 11 overs an hour. And also one of the graceful elements of the game had gone. Also front foot driving, that was going as well. So I believe the absence of spin bowling was affecting batting as well. And I got angry about it. And I went up and down the country talking to Johnny Wardle, Jim Laker, Richie Beno, Roy Tattersall, Eric Hollies, Doug Wright. Doug Wright told me about a leg spinner on the staff. Said, has he ever talked to you? No. But Doug, you got 7 first-class hat-tricks. He didn't want to talk to me. I couldn't believe it. So I got angry about it. And unbelievably, I took a chance. Gubby Allen heard about it, summoned me down to Lords, Gubby Allen, to tell me he approved thoroughly what I was doing. We'd never met before. Diametrically opposed in so many areas, Gubby Allen and I, and he agreed to write the foreword for me.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. Mm-hmm.
Some people have told me about that subsequently, said that is the biggest feather in the cap of your career, which I was very, very touched by. I know a lot of people said, how did you fix that? Doug Insull helped, but I was chuffed to bits with that. And it came out just as Abdul Qader was beginning to weave his spell in 1982. I was thrilled. But let's not run away with the fact that it led to there was a renaissance of spin bowling subsequently. There was up to a point, but it took Shane Warne a decade later to popularise leg spin. Then we had Mushtaq, etc., etc. But there still has not been, in the last 40 years, massive, stellar involvement from spin bowling. There still is too much medium pace and seam to my eyes. But it's better than it was when I was researching and writing that polemic.
Pat, say what's in a properly run world, you'd be prime minister. That's become clear.
At very least, dictator of British sport.
I couldn't afford the drop.
What would
in
you
salary.
Do? You could. I realise it. I know the current prime minister finds it hard to live within his means. What about what measures would you take to deal with the future of cricket, and what are the evils you would seek to remedy?
Well, I'd get rid of the 100 for a start. I think that is just exists to make money. I don't believe that the difference of 20 deliveries per innings makes a marked difference between that and T20. So I also believe that the ECB are now looking to downgrade the county championship. I think they'd be very, very happy if there were only 12 county clubs. They're keen on amalgamation. And I think they would be very, very happy if cricket was only played on test match grounds or at the very least T20 grounds. I believe marketing people are getting more and more involved now in cricket. County cricket, they keep saying, well, nobody watches county cricket. Well, they do from afar. You only have to see what the commentary figures are like for local radio, for example. It's very, very popular on local radio. And county cricket still remains the litmus paper test for you stepping up to the plate to play test match cricket, which for me is the acme, the pinnacle. I don't believe the ECB are respecting county cricket enough. And they're looking at the balance sheet. And I just don't see why the 100 should have been allowed to get through. I also worry about English cricket being marginalised behind the paywall that constitutes Sky's coverage. I know the amount of money that comes in massively from Sky to English cricket, but that in many cases is at a cost. And fewer people are playing cricket now every summer. The latest figure I heard was 170,000 less in the last decade. People find their own figures, I'm sure. Round my way, more and more clubs are going to the wall, not playing Sunday cricket, for example. Kids aren't playing. All they want to do is play T20, then go off and do something else. We're losing that umbilical cord that we used to have. And more people from humble backgrounds aren't playing top-class cricket. Only three black players have played Test match cricket for England this century. And the latest England team that played in the Test match against Pakistan, the last Test match of the series, seven of those 11 were privately educated. Now, this is not a swipe at the public school system. It's an acknowledgement that the best facilities are there. Obviously, parental support is massive, driving them around, getting them proper equipment, proper coaching, all the rest of it. The people who I've admired down the years who came from nowhere to be top-class cricketers, it's more and more difficult now for them to make a mark. And I believe cricket, if not already, is in danger of being marginalised behind these sort of influences that don't let the game prosper and grow.
Pat, that's a very, very strong agenda. You've given us lots of things to reflect on for us and our listeners. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honour to have you.
We could have talked to you for ages. It was a glorious insights into all sorts, the arts of commentary, the arts of reporting, and long may they last. Thank you very, very much indeed, Pat Murphy.
Thank you both. Thank you.
And now it remains only to say goodbye from me, Richard Heller, in South East London.
And goodbye from Peter Oborne here in West London.
And from me, Pat Murphy, in Worcestershire. Goodbye.